The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves.
Oh, well, welcome everyone to the National Intelligence Report here on Republic Broadcasting Network on the 25th day of August in the year of 2023. And folks, here is your first warning. You only have four more shopping months left till Christmas. Don't mess it up. Only four more shopping months. But one of the things that I would like for you to think about while we're in the giving mood is let's see what we can do to go to republicbroadcasting.org. Let's help out. Push that donate button. Let's see and make every effort that we possibly can to keep free speech going in this country, because it's going away like so many other things. And many of you probably aren't noticing it as much, but it's beginning to happen, and there are efforts afoot everywhere to try to curb your ability to hear the truth. But I'm very fortunate tonight in that I have my good buddy Cal Robbins from out there in nice and toasty Arizona. Cal, are you with us, buddy?
I'm here. Can you hear me, Mike?
Yeah. Wow. Hear you fine, bud.
Thanks for inviting me along, Mike. I understand you've got some more information to share. I feel like I'm that movie National Treasure with Nicolas Cage. That's about what it sounds like we're on an adventure today.
Well, thank you, buddy. And unfortunately, we had our good buddy DW scheduled to be with us. But, oh, man, I tell you what, he's had a heck of a day. Had equipment breakdown. I just talked to him a few minutes ago. He was apologizing for not being able to make it. And I told him, don't apologize for things that are out of your control, buddy. You couldn't stop an equipment breakdown. There's no way possible that you could have known that. But anyway, today we are going to delve into, if I may, Cal, I think I would like to call this the largest fraud that was ever perpetrated on a people in American history. And I know we can't wait for the pushback, because it's coming, but the largest fraud that has ever been foisted on this country was the Constitution of 1787. We had a pretty decent government, certainly wasn't perfect because it was man-made, but we had a pretty good government under the Articles of Confederation. I mean, look at all the stuff we had. We had, term limits. No one could serve in government for more than 3 years out of any six. We had instant recall if they didn't do what they said they were going to do when they were campaigning for election or what have you. Then if they didn't do it, they got there, the people could call them back, say, okay, you didn't do what you said you would do. Immediate recall. Now try that today after you vote your senator in for 6 years, and then try to get them an immediate recall on that. And also, you know, we had that wonderful thing called consent of the governed in the old Articles of Confederation. And consent of the governed meant that before any law could pass Congress, it had to be approved by every state in the Union. Not three quarters, not two thirds, not a simple majority. It had to be every state in the Union. Now, how much fraud, Cal, do you think that they could get by with if every state had to approve every law that Congress passed.
They would have a very difficult time getting any fraud past anybody. That's why consent of the governed doesn't work for a national government.
Well, they can't have that.
That's why consent of the governed doesn't work for an empire.
Exactly. They're
contradictory to each other.
Very much so. And, well, you know, probably we ought to define our terms. You know, I said a fraud. And so what is a fraud? A fraud is a deliberate attempt to deceive a targeted victim so as to obtain something of value from him, her, or what have you, that would have been difficult to obtain had the victim actually known the truth. Can you add to that in any way, Cal?
Look, there's that mute button. That's a very good definition of what I would consider to be a fraud.
Okay.
Intentionally misled someone in order to gain something from them is basically all a fraud is.
Well, I believe, and I think we can prove, that the Constitution was exactly that. They wanted to obtain something of value from the people, which was unlimited taxation, and we're going to really get into the numbers on that. But it was able to do that, and you know, and they were successful. So let me define success. Success is securing an advantage for yourself and your heirs that is almost impossible to lose, even under competitive conditions. Now, let's look at that. First, the perpetrator or perpetrators who designed the fraud and then executed is subsequently hailed by the victims as a hero. Well, we've certainly met that criteria. And they are called a genius and indispensable to their own well-being. Second, the perpetrators must be bound by an oath of non-disclosure, which all of them keep until they die. Well, when they met in Philadelphia in May of 1787, they took an oath for 50 years. I would imagine that everyone today, unless they were quite young, a teenager would say, well, I can take an oath of 50 years. I probably won't live that long. What do you think, Cal?
Well, especially back then. You know, life expectancy back then was, I don't know, if you were 45, you were an old man back then. So, yeah.
Yeah, life expectancy back then was in the 50s. So, yeah. And that, you know, you were considered, as you said, considered to be an old guy. But the purpose, as I said, they must be bound by that oath. Now, third, the nature of the fraud is well known by critics. Now, what else could we call them? Anti-federalists?
Yep.
Who tell their story in full public view at the time the fraud is being committed, but a majority of the victims reject this story. And fourth, the critics' negative assessment is forgotten over time, leaving the victims' heirs convinced that the original fraud was a great idea and well worth defending. And then fifth, anyone who discovers the true nature of the fraud cannot gain a hearing because the heirs of the victims dismiss them as a crackpot, a conspiracy theorist, you know, why don't you move to Guatemala or something like that, either in general or else regarding this specific issue. Now, sixth, the heirs of the perpetrators extract a growing percentage of the wealth of the heirs of the victims. Oh, 230 years of that. We've got all the evidence we need. Seventh, the fraud must have a slogan, preferably a very short slogan, easily memorized by the people, universally accepted, and devoid of any actual content, just in case someone should try to sue the perpetrator or his heirs for the commission of the crime. Is there anything better than "we the people," Cal?
No, that's what I thought of when you said there's a slogan. I know that slogan must be "we the people," because that is such a false statement.
Well, let's look into that. Let's go into that with a little bit of detail. And, you know, what we had about 9 million people in the 13 colonies in 1787. And 90 plus percent of those people were, and their, you know, counting them and their families, were inland farmers. The less than 10% were the wealthy, well-born aristocracy. Now, here's another thing I want to throw at you and throw at everyone for consumption here, is the fact that of the original 55 that showed up in Philadelphia, the 34 of them were lawyers. Now, here's a gross misrepresentation here, or overrepresentation, because lawyers back then made up less than 1% of the population, and yet at the Constitutional Convention, over 50% of the original 55, and then if we go to the 39 that signed it, 24 of them were lawyers, and that makes 61%. So do you see a gross overrepresentation of the legal industry here, Cal?
A way gross overrepresentation and a way gross underrepresentation of the people. You said back then it was approximately 6% of the people could vote.
Right.
Or even eligible to vote. That means 94% were not. So how is something created by less than 6% a voice of the 94% who could not vote? How does that work, Mike?
It doesn't work. It worked for them real well, but it doesn't.
Right. It's a fraud. That's okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. If you put the word fraud on there, it works, Mike.
Oh yes, absolutely. And we look at the fact that not one inland farmer, in other words, 90% of the people of that 9 million, 90% of them had no representation whatsoever in this Constitution. And yet, they went to, it's just incredible the way that things worked here. You know, they were able to get it by, slip it by, do what they needed to do. And, you know, and the people just kind of fell in line because the rich aristocracy controlled the news media of the day, which were the newspapers, the great majority of them. But the people had no representation whatsoever. But, you know, we'll start this thing off with a preamble that says, "We the people." And I don't know, you can put in "We the people" into a search engine today and see how many million responses you get. They really hooked them with that one. We the people. So we know that the common everyday person was not represented in this government at all. And that may have been the reason, Cal, don't you think, that when they got to the end of August of 1787 and Elbridge Gerry made a motion to put in a Bill of Rights, and it was seconded by George Mason, but then the lawyers there said, "Well, no, we can't do that. We've been here for 3 months now. It's hot. You know, we don't have time to do a Bill of Rights." To which, and I've said this on multiple occasions, but George Mason goes, "Well, wait a minute. I've got 9 state bills of rights here. I could create a Bill of Rights in, you know, just a couple of hours." Nope. Federalists wouldn't have it. Now, Cal, what does it tell you that a group of people did not want to give the people a Bill of Rights?
It tells me they weren't interested in securing the people's rights. That wasn't their purpose. It's pretty simple to see, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And then they didn't want the people being able to limit them in any way. Go ahead.
Yeah, if the government had to, you know, honor the people's rights, they couldn't do most of the stuff that they do. But, you know, this wasn't about governing people. This was about creating a commercial empire. So, yeah, you can't have people's rights standing in the way of that. Especially just us little peon people.
Well,
you know, we can't vote anyway back then.
Right. You know, but then they made the arrangement to where, okay, we're going to let you vote, but it doesn't mean anything. So it's
that's just a testament to the success part of their fraud.
Oh, yes. So it's absolutely amazing to me. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, and DW and quite a few other people. Is it the fact that people just flat can't see this, Cal? Because we are you want to talk about this thing that they put together in 1787. Man, it's in full bloom right now. I mean, this could not be anything but the manifestation of what they intended from the very beginning. Because who's running this country? The wealthy aristocracy. And it was the wealthy aristocracy who created the Constitution to start with. I mean, you know, let's take a look at, back then, and I found some statistics, in the last couple of days. They just have freaked me out. And number one was the fact that of the 100 wealthiest families in Virginia in 1787, well over half of them were related to each other. And then I got to digging a little deeper, and I found out that just like today, there's an inner circle, and they marry and intermarry within this inner circle. And if a woman suddenly says, oh, well, I found this guy down here, and he's just a commoner, just a common worker, and we fell in love, the family would say, well, if you get married, you're done. You're disinherited. It's all over. That is verifiable. And when we start looking at all of these individuals who were there at the Constitutional Convention, and stop and look at Pennsylvania, how in the world could the people who made those, who wrote "We the People," how could they say that when all eight or seven, actually all seven delegates from the state of Pennsylvania were all from the same city, Philadelphia? How could anyone pretend for a minute that the people out there in the hinterlands, the inland farmers who are out there struggling to make a living, they probably didn't even know there was a constitutional convention going on? What do you think, Cal?
Well, they definitely probably did not know that the convention was going on. They had other concerns. They had their lives to live, you know. And these lawyers, they had nothing better to do but to try and build themselves an empire, and they've been quite successful at it if you look around.
We are seeing it in full bloom today, because the people in this country, anyone who actually believes you have any rights, you are eligible immediately for mental health care, because you have no rights. And the courts keep saying it over and over. I keep hearing people, you know, well, my Second Amendment. Well, you know, a federal judge just said in Missouri, you don't have a Second Amendment because of the Supremacy Clause. And the Supremacy Clause was originally written by Luther Martin, but then when Luther Martin left the convention, you know, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton and his group got in control of that. But here's the one thing I wanted to really get into, Cal, was they were really pitching they needed a government of more energy, because they said, oh, well, we've got all of these debts we've got to pay. You know, we've got all of the debts from the war. Well, Cal, I got some actual numbers from some documents that I took out of the box. And I've got some actual figures, and that is approximately $10 million was owed to foreign countries in 1787. Approximately $10 million. Now, do you want to take a wild guess on how much money was owed to the wealthy aristocracy, many of whom were at the Constitutional Convention, Cal?
I would guess somewhere in the neighborhood of $40
billion. Well, you're a little light. It was somewhere between $50 and $60 million was owed to the people who were writing the Constitution and their extended families. When you look at this massive fraud, it is absolutely, you know, we have, okay, you know, we go back to 1781. Robert Morris is brought in as the financier of the war for the colonies, for the states. He's made the financier. One of the first things he does is he creates a bank called the Bank of North America. Who was the president of that bank, Cal?
Willing?
Yes.
Not Robert Willing. What's his first name?
Thomas.
Thomas Willing, yes.
Yes, and he was Robert Morris's business partner.
Yes.
Okay, did you know that...
how much of that debt was owed to Willing and Morris?
Well, I can't... I don't have
it down that far? Okay.
No, I don't have that... I may find it, but it is quite extensive. But anyway, we know that... you know, Sentinel, Samuel Bryan, said that he made it pretty specific that $17 million of that was owed to Robert Morris himself. So the government owed one man more money than they owed the other countries, almost twice as much to one man as they owed the other countries. Okay, now just to jump forward a little bit, and once Washington took office after his election, Cal, would you be surprised to know that in George Washington's administration, I'm not talking about the people elected to Senate or the people elected to the House of Representatives, but within his administration, would you believe, except for Thomas Jefferson, they were almost all of his administration were related by marriage?
That wouldn't shock me at all.
And then when Alexander Hamilton, who was made Secretary of Treasury, when Alexander Hamilton creates the first Bank of the United States because the Bank of North America had gone bust, so then... Alexander Hamilton is put into that position, and he creates, again, the first bank of the United States. Who was the president of that bank, Cal?
Did they make Willing president of him of that bank as well?
Ding, Thomas ding, Willing? Ding, ding. We have a winner.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Shocking.
Okay. And we all know that Alexander Hamilton was married to Philip Schuyler's daughter, and Schuyler was the richest man in New York, very much into land speculation and you know, buying up. He had been very active in buying up debt. And then, of course, they are Hamilton is coordinating, and I've got these documents to prove it. Hamilton was coordinating with his brother-in-law, John Barker Church, who had gone back to England. And they were coordinating and working together back and forth on this assumption bill where Hamilton, knowing in advance that he was going to push for an assumption bill, which would mean that they would go in and pay off all of the state debts, you know, which was really going to hamper some of the states because, like, Virginia had paid her debt off. But now they were all going to be taxed to pay the whole debt, which meant that now Virginia, the people in Virginia, were going to be taxed to pay for the people in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts who had hardly paid anything on theirs. Is that that's a little tough. But anyway, Hamilton knew he was going to push for this, and he called it the Assumption Bill. And he knew that that was exactly what he was going to do. And so he coordinated with his brother-in-law, John Barker Church, who, as I said, had gone back to England. And that's a very funny story, Cal. You want to tell the story of John Barker Church coming to the U.S. as a pauper because he was escaping debtor's prison in England, and he comes to the United States and then starts loaning the United States money to conduct a war?
Yeah, that is rather odd, isn't it? How somebody who's a supposedly broke and escaping debt comes here and he's able to finance millions of dollars here. Of course, when you take a look at who John Barker Church or John Carter's uncle was, it kind of makes more sense. And his uncle was John Church. John, oh man, it's escaping me right now. But anyway, his uncle was the minister of the assurance company, the monopoly of assurance, which is now called insurance, for London, for the Bank of London.
Yes. And so obviously
they knew all the trade that was going on. They knew how much money was going. They had their fingers on the pulse of pretty much all transactions.
Well, from the documents I've been looking at, it would appear that John Barker Church from England was loaning money to family members and to extended family members in the area during that time to go into states and to buy up these IOUs. And they were buying these IOUs for about 10 cents, what we would call today, 10 cents on the dollar. They were buying them up, and most of the people who had these IOUs from the government thought, well, what the dickens? We're probably never going to get anything for them, so here's somebody who wants to give me 10 cents on the dollar. I'm going to take it because I need it to buy seeds. I need it to get, horses. I need to get this stuff. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. But then once all of these IOUs were bought up, and there is documented evidence that Alexander Hamilton and others actually sent people out in carriages and sent them into the South and other states to buy up as many of these IOUs as they could get, because Hamilton, being Secretary of the Treasury, knew that if he got this assumption bill passed, then they could demand that all of these IOUs be paid off in hard money, gold or silver.
At par value.
Yes.
At that other 90%. Par. And they right. need to tax these people who they just built out of that money. They're going to tax these very same people to pay that debt to themselves.
Absolutely.
The debt they owe to themselves. I mean, it's important to note that, you're saying, they were these mostly farmers, and they were issued script, and it was devalued like crazy, and they ended up selling it at disc, 10 cents on the dollar, as you say. The debt they owed was to these people to begin with. This is kind of like the housing thing that happened back in 2008. It's very similar to that.
Well, it's just another scheme of the bankers.
It is.
And
the Constitution had to be created in order to do it. That's yes. the fraud.
And that is absolutely, Cal, why the first power they gave to Congress was the power of unlimited taxation.
Mike, that's such a hard sell for most people to understand, because everybody's been taught, oh, no, they didn't have the power to tax you. That power to tax people directly came from the 16th Amendment. No, it didn't. The 16th Amendment just removed the requirement of apportionment to direct taxes.
Well, here comes the music, buddy. We'll be back on the flip side, folks. Stay with us here at Republic Broadcasting Network.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Einstein once said, "Future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies." What did he know? Imagine you hear ocean waves caressing a beach, or a favorite song from the past, or the trickle of the babbling brook. All of these are sound frequencies that positively affect us. Terahertz is a soothing, healing frequency that has been proven to resonate at the same frequency as healthy cells. It penetrates the body and stimulates new healthy cell growth. Want to diminish muscle aches, joint pains, and experience a greater sense of well-being? Tired of spending money on short-term remedies that never seem to work? Soothing, healing, relaxing terahertz frequency is now available and as handy as flipping a switch. Terahertz technology is changing the course of what we were taught about how to maintain our health and well-being. To read more about this amazing breakthrough and to order your terahertz frequency wand, go to naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
Sing this song,
doo da, doo da.
The Cape Town racetrack 5 mile long,
oh de doo da day.
I went down there when my hat came in,
doo da, doo da.
I come back home with a pot full of tin,
oh de doo da.
Hey guys, I'm just barely hearing the music. Are we coming through? Okay, can we start now? Okay, all right, guys. Thank you very much. Probably a glitch on my end there, but one of the things that I wanted to do was to kind of point out, pardon me, the people who are involved in this fraud on so many levels, it is absolutely incredible. You know, when we look at the people who were involved with the Bank of North America, and then the same group of people who then became involved in the First Bank of the United States, and I'll just give you some names. Probably most of them you've never heard of because I'm sure you weren't taught this in school. In Philadelphia, the people who were involved in both the Bank of North America and the First Bank of the United States were Thomas Willing, William Bingham, Robert Morris, George Clymer, and Thomas Fitzsimmons. And then among the Federalist elite of New England who were also involved were George Cabot, Fisher Ames, and Stephen Higginson of Massachusetts. Then in the circle of wealth in New York was Brockholst Livingston, Rufus King, Philip Livingston, Philip Schuyler, Alexander Hamilton's father-in-law, and Nicholas Lowe. With regard to the wealth holdings that the Federalist Program, all of these, this wealth did not create new businesses, but the profits off of these banks went to make these people who held the stock and who were involved to make them more and more wealthy. So, Cal, your thoughts?
Yeah, but there it is. Can we add George Washington's name to that list?
Yes, without a doubt. He was okay. Very much involved with that. Probably the richest man in Virginia.
Yeah, I figured we should put, you know, a name everybody's probably heard of in that list of people who were part of the fraud, because this is what you're doing, is you're naming the conspirators of this fraud, is basically what you're doing. And most of the names people haven't heard of, but there are also some well-known names in this fraud. And you'll find them also, as some of them, as the delegates to the convention. It's amazing how that works, isn't it?
Yes. And, of course, again, I mentioned Thomas Willing before, but he was president of the Bank of the United States from its inception in 1791 until 1807. So that's how long he was president of that bank and in control of much of the money, you know, that was happening. You know, he was, of course, Robert Morris's business associate, and they remained friends. And Willing's daughter, Anne, married Morris's nephew.
Yeah.
No, the son married John Marshall's
daughter. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So, you know, what was it, George Carlin once said, it's a big club and you ain't in it.
Was true.
Oh, big time. Many times over. It is one that we are just not in. And, you know, as I look at more and more of these documents and these things coming up, and I was not aware that the bank as it was instituted, and I'm learning every day, as originally constituted, the bank, the First Bank of the United States, had a mixed public-private character. The federal government was to own one-fifth of the stock of the institution, prescribed in 1791 at $10 million, and a select five of the bank's 25-man board of directors. So you see, they were always in the minority. There was no way that they could ever vote against the powers that had the money. The voting power of the big stockholders was restricted to a maximum of 30 votes per person. Yeah, that's really bad, isn't it? To many citizens, such arrangements apparently provided adequate protection of the public interest. Yeah, right. Yet there is a serious question as to whether the First Bank of the United States was in any respect free from domination by elite interest. And as I said, you know, I went over the people who were in the, you know, the part of it. So I don't know, Cal, you know, when we look at this and look at the family connections, and then we look at today, we look at what we're dealing with today, and we're seeing exactly the same thing. And many of these people, you don't know their names, just like back then, the common inland farmer, 90% of the American population probably didn't know any of these people by name. They certainly didn't move in their circles. So, your thoughts, Cal?
It's such a huge conspiracy of fraud that these people have done. You said, you know, that somehow the simple man was protected, and you know, this wasn't something that the wealthy aristocracy could just take over. How could it not? Because that's all the people that had it. 5%, you know, the government owning 5% of the shares. Well, the government's the wealthy aristocracy itself. So I don't understand how there was ever a thought or an argument that this wasn't a creation by, of, and for the wealthy aristocracy. Meaning the bank, and then you can, you know, then when you look at the government they created, you're kind of figure out it's not a government of we, the people, by the people, for the people, but more of a government of the aristocracy, for the aristocracy, created by the lawyers of the banksters. It would be in that fit.
Here was something I found interesting, and that was, you know, we talked about them going in and buying up these IOUs and all of what they call securities. And because of so many of these securities had been bought at severely depressed prices, as I said before, like 10 cents on the dollar, but they were bought from people of very limited means. Their luck, you know, was not that good. And then I've got to give one of these guys credit, and that would have been James Madison. You know, from time to time, I've said he was the Bill Clinton of the founding era. But James Madison, of all people, urged that a distinction be made with regard to funding between those notes that were still held by their original owners and those that had been picked up later for a comparative pittance by these speculators. In other words, Madison did not want to give these speculators the full face value, but his plea in Congress was just completely ignored. And thanks mainly to the efforts of Alexander Hamilton and his economic supporters in Congress, this part of the funding plan was adopted too, with the result that a fairly small number of persons were suddenly even more rich, their fortunes many times doubled or tripled by a sum variously estimated between $40 and $60 million. That was a lot of money back then, guys. And, of course, we'd have to look at the role that was played by Alexander Hamilton and certain members of his extended family and his close business associates. Before and during the heated congressional debate over the issue, a number of Hamilton's friends and kinsmen were heavily involved in public securities ownership and speculation, much of it based on advance inside information, which I just mentioned before, that is documented. Now, one of those individuals was William Duer, D-U-E-R, Hamilton's longtime friend and relative, who was unwisely appointed early in Washington's administration as the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. So, Duer was guilty of the gravest malfeasance, and he was up to his eyes in speculation in the public debt while he was the Assistant Secretary of Treasury. But who controlled the judicial branch? Nothing was going to happen to him, I promise you. Now, one of the things that I wanted to bring out here, and just to throw in as a side note, because I think it is so... Cal, are you familiar with John Rutledge?
No, not much. I've heard the name.
Okay, Rutledge was a big-time investor. He had several plantations in South Carolina. He lived in Charleston, was extremely wealthy, and probably the only man who told the truth at the convention. And here's what he said, because they were going back and forth, and this was in a this was right before Luther Martin left. They were bantering back and forth about the morality of what was being done, which Luther Martin and John Francis Mercer were pushing on. And here was the response from John Rutledge. Now I'm going to tie something else with Rutledge here. Rutledge said, and I quote, "Religion and humanity have nothing to do with this Constitution. Financial interest alone is the governing principle of all nations." What do you think, buddy?
Well, he spoke the truth.
Well, you know, later on...
Go ahead. You got to give him credit for being honest.
Yeah. Yeah, but they thought that they were at a convention to where what they said nobody was going to know about for 50 years, so he didn't mind telling the truth. So he said it pretty straight up. Now, one of the things in doing my research, one of the other things I found was under the Washington administration, Washington appoints Mr. Rutledge to the U.S. Supreme Court. Does that surprise you, Cal?
No, not at all.
Okay. Would it surprise you to know that he sat on the U.S. Supreme Court for 2.5 years and never heard a case?
That wouldn't surprise me either.
He was paid as a Supreme Court justice for 2.5 years and many occasions didn't even show up. That's the perks you get when you are involved in the inner circle, in this wealthy elite, the wealthy aristocracy, as Hamilton said. And, you know, and what was it that Washington said? We have a right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience. Folks, that's documented. But, Cal, here's the thing. I mean, there's several more things we can go into here, but my question is this. Why is it that people can't see this, Cal?
A lot of it's the indoctrination that everybody goes through the public schools, government schools. And another part of it is that they don't want to see it. They have the Constitution. They identify themselves with it. Because it says we the people, they think they are part of it. They have been so ingrained into them that if you point this out as a flaw or you point this out as, you know, something wrong or negative, they take it personal. They have taken on the Constitution and the government as they are we the people. They are the government. And to criticize them, to criticize the government or the Constitution, is they correlate that as a direct criticism as them. That's the only thing I can think of, Mike, because a rational person wouldn't be that way. But they are emotionally invested into it to where they identify it. And you can tell they do it because they'll say, well, this is our Constitution. It's not the Constitution. It's our Constitution. You can see the ownership in the way they speak. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, and you just made me think of something that happened to me today on Facebook. I had asked a constitutional question, and some guy who has on his – he's not one of my friends, but he had on his Facebook page that he was a historian. And so I made a comment about the people who left the Constitutional Convention. – And if you didn't know the people who left, and if you didn't know why they left, you can't really understand the Constitution. Is that a fair statement, Cal?
That's a completely fair statement. If you don't, I would add to it, if you haven't read the letters between those who called themselves Federalists prior to the Constitution, when they spoke of what they were up to, this criminal conspiracy they were up to, you don't know the Constitution.
Well,
you don't know the intent, because we're taught the intent was all to, you know, secure the rights and liberty of the people. Well, so far you've already shown that it was about creating a commercial empire. It's about money, not about religion or morality. That's what they were there for. And like I say, the only reason I can see it is people don't want to believe that. They do not want to believe that is the truth, even though it is, and there's so much documentation out there to show it, but nobody wants, even, you can show it to them, Mike, and they'll reject you on it.
Well, I did that this morning with this gentleman, this historian, and Cal, I got called a new name with a new way of looking at it that just absolutely kind of flabbergasted me. He said that if a person wanted to know all of this stuff, the very fact that they wanted to know all of this background would make them a narcissist.
What?
Yeah, that's what he called me.
Okay, obviously doesn't know what a narcissist is.
Well, I got called once.
I would call you a masochist getting punished by people. You keep going out there getting beat up by people for it, but yeah, that's not narcissism. Oh. Yeah, it's not fun to tell the truth sometimes, right? Most people don't want to deal with it.
That is true. Sounds like we got some music coming up, buddy. See you on the other side.
All right.
Hello, hello, hello from beautiful Colorado. My name is Samuel Jung Kay, and I am currently the lead Shilajit hunter and master herbalist for Colorado Shilajit Company. In this video series, I will be discussing what we believe is the greatest of all adaptogenic superfoods and the single greatest natural healing remedy gifted to us by Mother Earth. I think you too will become as excited by this incredible substance called Shilajit as we were and are after our discovery of this amazing gift right here in beautiful, colorful Colorado. You may already know Shilajit by other names, Shilajit, Momio, Momi, Mami, Mineral Pitch, Asphaltum, and others. Shilajit literally translates to destroyer of weakness and conqueror of mountains. Shilajit has been in use for thousands of years and is considered as the highest valued cure-all of any earthly substance.
Look for the gold mountain and medical symbol logo in banners on republicbroadcasting.org to watch the full video and see more information. Use code GORBN when ordering. That's GORBN.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Black Owl Coffee, and I started Black Owl because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee that's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Standing 6'4", weighing 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian. And my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the Republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the Republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. Fuck you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central.
Welcome back, folks, to the National Intelligence Report here on Republic Broadcasting Network. And we are delving into quite a bit of early history. And I'm sure that there are at least 300 million people out there who don't want to believe it and wouldn't believe it, even if you could show them the proof. But, Cal, I hope you don't mind. I'm kind of going to break this up a little bit, and I'm going to read you something. If you would be so kind as to try to guess who said it. Are you ready?
Go for it.
All right. People produce wealth. free people. And as they learn, there is little reward for ambition, that it requires faith to risk, and they have none, as the government must restrict and penalize and tax incentive and endeavor and must increase its expenditure of bounties, then this government must assume more and more police powers. And we find we are becoming a government-fearing people and not a God-fearing people. We find we have replaced faith with fear. And though we may give lip service to the Almighty, in reality, the government has become our God. It is therefore basically ungodly government, and its appeal to the pseudo-intellectual and the politician is to change their status from servant of the people to master of the people, to play at being God without any faith in God and without the wisdom of God. Its pseudo-liberal spokesmen and some Harvard advocates have never examined the logic of its substitution of what it calls human rights for individual rights, for its propaganda play upon words has appeal for the unthinking. Let us send the message back to Washington by our representatives who are with us here today, that from this day forward we are standing up, and the heel of tyranny does not fit an upright man. It is an idea of government that encourages our fears and destroys our faith. For where there is faith, there is no fear. And where there is fear, there is no faith. In encouraging our fears of economic insecurity, it demands we place that economic management and control with government. In encouraging our fear of educational development, it demands that we place that education and the minds of our children under management and control of government. And even feeding our fears of physical infirmities and declining years, it offers and demands to father us through it all right to the grave. It is a government that claims to us that it is as bountiful as it buys its power from us with the fruits of its rapaciousness of the wealth that free men before it have produced, and builds on crumbling credit without responsibility to the debtors who are our children. That's it, Cal. Who do you think said that?
Was that Spooner?
Nope.
McGovern?
Nope.
Or not McGovern. Yeah. Who was it, Mike? I give on this one. I've heard it before. I don't remember who said it.
George Wallace.
George Wallace. Not McGovern. Wallace. Wrong George.
Wrong George. Yeah.
Wrong George.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they had to call him a racist first. And it always amazed me that because he said segregation now, segregation yesterday, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, they said that he was a racist. And yet when the Supreme Court said the same thing, they said nothing. Wow, folks, we'll be back on the other side. It's the least we can do for the red, white, and blue. We must take America back. We must take America back.
Here's some interesting news. Due to all the recent claims about possible nuclear wars, viruses, solar flares, and civil unrest, people are scrambling to prepare and stockpile food. But the one thing out of reach for many is an underground bunker. Until now. Because you can now have a 3D printed underground bunker in just one day. An excavator digs a hole in your backyard, and 3DBunkers.com shows up in a small truck and sets up their 3D printer under a tent completely undetected. They can print as many rooms as you want at a fraction of the cost compared to traditional metal bunkers. 3D Bunkers uses polymer concrete, which is 5 times stronger than regular cement. YouTube 3DBunkers.com and watch the video. The creators of 3D Bunkers is looking for a business partner that can help bring this technology to the world. And we need to protect our way of life without living in fear. Contact Brad at 3DBunkers.com for more details, or visit 3DBunkers.com.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.